This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Mila Kaslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. Today, we'll be talking with Joe McDonnell. He's a Canadian-born American architect, researcher, and professor who will be talking about the future of architecture. So good to see you, Joe.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. And now I'm going to throw this over to you, Eli, to get us started.
Well, I think one of the reasons I was interested and excited to have you on this show, because I know you're at the forefront of a lot of new design practices, especially using software and digital fabrication, and also what something's called parametric modeling. And it'd be great for, of course, a lot of people don't know what that is or means. It'd be great to have you talk a little bit about that and also explain to people what that
is. Especially the parametric modeling piece.
Sure. Parametric modeling, the word parametric is exactly what it means. It's setting up parameters within architectural design. So I give a lecture called The Agency of Constraints. And it's kind of a agency is a good thing and constraint sounds like a bad thing, but actually combined, they're an amazing thing. So the best way to describe parametric modeling is if you think of, there are two kinds of wire mesh. One is called welded wire mesh. So if you imagine a square grid of wires, like a screen, for example, those intersections that create the squares of the wire mesh are fixed. They're welded together. So that screen, no matter how hard you pull and push on it, it does not move. Those intersections do not move. However, if you think of your window screen, a simple window screen at home on your window, that is called woven wire mesh. So take that window screen out and pull on it, and you'll see that all of those thousands of intersections will move in tandem with each other. So you push and you pull, and it's as if each intersection knows, quote unquote, knows the whereabouts of every other intersection. So now when we're talking about parametric modeling in architecture, on a surface, for example, we're talking about a million intersections that you begin to set up parameters for how and when they move.
So I think, just to explain, because a lot of people are not technical, I think in a lot of ways parameters would be, for example, on a much more simpler level, is let's say you have a virtual cube and a computer-aided drafting program. The computer, it has dimension, like maybe 3 inches in one way, 3 inches another way, and 4 inches another way. But it also sits in a virtual space like Cartesian geometry, you know, X, Y, Z, like you used to do in math, right?
Right.
So what parameters, though, is that instead of directly manipulating the object using a mouse and moving it around inside, you're actually manipulating the fields or the dimensions of it numerically, right? So you could say, all right, now it's 3 inches, but now I'm going to change it to 5 inches. You just change the 4 to a 5, and the cube becomes 5 inches. So basically, you're changing the parameters of an object. So what Joe is explaining to a certain extent, that a lot of surfaces are designed with these complex, you know, different kind of facets, if you will. Right? And that's how they make curved surfaces.
So this implies greater strength, I guess? Am I looking
flexibility
at that correctly?
Flexibility,
yes.
Yeah, there are many benefits from it. Just a brief history of parametric modeling. It actually comes from the aerospace and automotive engineering fields. And the primary driver is a company called Dassault Systèmes out of Paris. And they have a software called CATIA, C-A-T-I-A. And so in my office, and when I was on faculty at Harvard, that is the software that I began to learn and explore. And so it's a very technical software. It's the software that Frank Gehry uses to create his complex curving geometries. And so our work does align with work like Frank Gehry's. They are non-repeating geometries. They are what we call idiosyncratic geometries. They can, yes, absolutely, through complex curvature. For example, on a plane, on a car, they can create dramatic stiffness by their curving geometries, yeah.
You know, and I hope that this question, you know, I'm a layperson. This is the first I'm hearing about this, but I find everything interesting. And I think about that building that collapsed in Florida.
Yes.
Would that have, that kind of design in that parking lot where they claim that slab collapsed, would that kind of design have prevented something like that? Is that a fair question?
My understanding of what happened in Florida is that the engineering calculations for the span of the beams that held up that concrete parking garage failed. And so the calculations, which were likely manual or at least not complex on the computer, either it was a cost savings measure. You know, in architecture, we call it value engineering, where we try to make the building cheaper. This happens in infrastructure like roads and bridges.
And right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that I believe that's exactly what happened.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
But this is also why, in some ways, the importance of digital tools and designing buildings a certain way comes into play. Because, and again, going back to this thing about the parametric design, part of the parameters that you're working with could be the engineering aspect of the analysis of the structure, for example.
Absolutely. So, for example, you know, if we move back into the aerospace engineering field, the plane has to be the lightest possible it can be to perform its function. But at the same time, if you have 300 passengers flying 500 miles an hour, I mean, life safety is everything on
Absolutely.
That plane.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So this is interesting. So in some ways, what you're doing is, let's say, by doing the parameters, you're balancing out the needs of the passengers, the size of the wing that you can change by, say, changing the numbers, the weight of the plane, the kind of materials. So all aspects that feed into it. And that's why, in some ways, this is really an important development in the future of architecture. Of course, it's not just doing the drawings and handing over to engineering firm and then developing whatever the parameters are in terms of the structure and stuff. You can do it simultaneously.
Correct, right? Yeah.
So, but I think you also, to shift the conversation a little bit, you also have a very interesting background.
You're a graduate of the Harvard School of Design. Can you tell us about the school and why it's unique and what influence it had on your work?
Sure. I finished up my graduate studies at the design school, and it was a really important time. It was in the mid-90s, and that was the time that all of the graduate programs in the U.S. were deciding on which software they would choose to primarily do their renderings in. So they were looking at, so some schools chose to choose animation software, like Maya, for example. But I was actually hired to make that choice on behalf of the design school. We ended up inviting the president of Dassault Systèmes over to the school. We encouraged him to, you know, have a conversation with the faculty. And then, of course, we tapped him for 24 workstations, which he kindly donated. Yes.
Christ. So in some ways, that it'd be interesting to hear about how this, your teaching and also how the use of and your research into these different kinds of technologies has influenced your current work and your current practice.
Yes.
I imagine must have a powerful influence on it, yeah.
I launched my practice in 2002, and that was only made possible by a series of research grants that were awarded by the dean at Harvard. And so I was able to explore and manufacture product design, exploring parametric modeling with that software, CATIA. Now, when I then moved the practice to New York, we, of course, a seat, which is a license, a single license for CATIA, is about $100,000. So luckily, Frank Geary was developing his own software that was less complicated and more geared towards architecture. And it's called Digital Project. So it was much more affordable, and that was the software that we then were working with.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Joe McDonnell about the future of architecture. So I have another question, Joe, for you, and I'd like to know more about the projects and exhibits that you've done, and what do you find most exciting in your work?
Well, it's interesting because I've run the practice now for about 18 years, and we have always been very curious about form finding. And so the idea that we can create experiential architecture through kind of experimentation and testing ideas, that lends itself well to temporary architecture or exhibit architecture. And so, for example, Eli and I have worked together on that those kind of projects. But at the same time, we also do more traditional buildings. So, for example, over the last half a dozen years, we've got into net zero design strategies. Now, net zero means that the building there is zero carbon emissions on the building. So we actually specialize in data center, net zero data centers, which is one of the most difficult buildings to achieve because, of course, a data center is filled with racks, mm-hmm. And servers, and it's a very hot environment. There are very few people there. And so to get it to net zero, you actually have to combine it with a hybrid energy source. So, for example, we just won an Opal Award in London for a data center in Nevada. So that was a combination of parametric modeling, emerging materials like low-carbon concrete, aerated concrete, plant walls. And at the same time, it was way out in the desert in Nevada because security is very important on data centers.
And it's so hot out there.
It was so hot, yeah. So it was actually a combination of solar panels and geothermal that mm-hmm. got that data center to net zero.
Oh, interesting. Now, this is a little different, and I know we're going to go back to architecture, but I'm thinking about a young person that might be listening to this show and wondering, how would they prepare for the kind of work that you do? You know, how do you prepare?
Well, it's interesting. In school, mm-hmm. both undergraduate architecture and graduate architecture, there is a new software out. It's been out for a while. It's been out for about 10 years by Bob McNeil out of Seattle, Washington. And it's called Rhinoceros. It is a very user-friendly tool that, you know, even kids in high school are picking up Rhino. And it is a parametric modeling tool that has a series of kind of really kind of fun named, they're called plugins. So for example, Rhino has a parametric plugin called Grasshopper. And with those two tools combined, you can create the same geometries that you can with some of these more robust heavy duty software.
So for example, like if you want to do, you were building a complex, you know, grid for a bridge or something, and you really said, oh, instead of like 20 members, you know, to upright members to support the cabling, whatever it is, you could do 40 of them and see what that does. And just by changing a number.
I mean, the whole point about parametric modeling is, one, it can create, you know, unprecedented forms. And that's what students really love about it. You know, they can create really wild, imaginative designs. But at the same time, it's also a very robust, basic tool. It is the iteration process in Rhino is so fast that you can go through 150 variations of a design of a project, a building, in a matter of a couple of days. And so there's a practical side, and then there's kind of a very imaginative side.
So I guess that's where the artists and creators would fit in when they're using this, right?
Yes. It does tread into the art world very easily.
Can you tell me what that would look like as a what does a tread into the art world? Or maybe Eli, you
no,
can
no,
say.
No, it's a very good question.
Yeah, what does that look like?
Well, I guess a supplement to that is, have you seen any work that you've seen using Rhino that you think is compelling?
Well, now we move from parametric modeling into machine learning and artificial intelligence. And this is something that's really important for us to talk about today, because we are on the very cutting edge of these new tools. Now, I can talk about it from an architectural point of view, and I can talk about it from an artistic point of view.
Both would be great.
Great. Well, let's deal with the architectural side, because at the moment, it's not all that interesting, I have to say. So for example, we all know that when architecture went digital, it went through a software called AutoCAD. Everybody's heard of AutoCAD. And then there was a revolution that came about because of a software called Revit. Now, the reason architects and also all the subcontractors, and now subcontractors include structure engineers, MEP engineers, that's mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and also facade engineers. Now, they love Revit because every part of the team, every person on the team works on a single model. Now, there used to be a problem in AutoCAD where the MEP drawings, for example, don't match the structural drawings, and you end up having pipes that are going through columns or beams, and it's a huge problem. And then what happens with the master file of Revit is that is avoided because everybody is working on the same virtual environment. And so it's very successful and it's very practical. Revit is not an exploratory tool. It is a practical tool.
No, I just want to add something because, we have an audience that may know some of these things. So just to give you a little bit of the history of the dance that architecture has with technology, when computer-aided drafting, which is the CAD software like AutoCAD, first came out, was just really more like drawing plans digitally, repeat elements, such like that. The generation that Joe is talking about is they realized at some point is that since it's software, why can't we also, when we put in, let's say, a beam, we could also put in what kind of material is or what the weight of it is, what the length is, things like that. And then if you're doing that, then you also simultaneously could say, well, how much stress would it have put on if it put 20 of them together or put it in this location? So the power of something like Revit is that everybody's working on this virtual model from different points of view. And as, let's say, the architects add more material or something like that, it's also calculating forces. It's calculating
Sounds like
mounts.
Civil engineering in a lot of ways. Eh?
Yeah, but this is why he says the AI part of it for architecture is not that interesting, because it's more in that realm of like almost like construction management
exactly.
as opposed
this
to creative.
This is exactly
right?
what it's starting
yeah.
to sound like.
Yes,
construction
it is.
Management.
But on very large buildings, like skyscrapers or very large residential projects or even infrastructural projects, the cost savings are dramatic when you use Revit, and because you are not making mistakes and you are using the bare minimum materials necessary to hold up that building and to do so with confidence, unlike the Miami project.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking with Joe McDonald. We're having a fascinating conversation about the future of architecture and technology and how all of these things intersect. And I'd like to ask you, where are women in this field? As I'm listening to you talk about, I've listened to both of you talk, and I'm saying to myself, I am sure that there are women in this field, but then, I wasn't one of those women. So if you could talk about what you're seeing, that would be something to hear.
Because I'm a I've always been a faculty member somewhere. We are seeing great strides in education in diversity and inclusion. So the current gender, we can talk about all sorts of disparities that mm-hmm. exist, but the one, if we're going to talk about gender, surprisingly, it's probably close to 55 to 45 women. Now. And so we've come a long way.
I'll say, we were going to talk about how art and this Revit kind of intersect. And I don't know if we got a chance to do that.
Well, it's not so much Revit, but also.
Not Revit, but yeah, go ahead.
But no, it's interesting. I think that between, Joe was starting to talk about machine learning and artificial intelligence and how in architecture that its impact has been kind of pedestrian, but in art it's been something else. It'd be great to hear you talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So I will give you one example of an artist that I am following. His work is fascinating. He's 35 years old. His name is Refik Anadol. He's Turkish. He lives in Los Angeles. And he is completely immersed in AI and what he calls cognitive dreaming.
Interesting. Yeah, I like the title.
His work is fascinating. So what he does is he collects thousands and thousands of images of a city, and then it goes through a series of algorithms, and then it gets projected onto surfaces. And for me, his most successful project to date was when he took all of the archives of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the building was designed by Frank Gehry, and he projected all of this data onto the building at night. So it not only was it musical scores, it was also sounds, and it was just all the recordings that they had on file, and it became just this symphony of raw data, but it was just so beautiful to see. Without being fully aware of the environment that you're experiencing, he calls it a collective memory, which means that even though you may not know the score of the sound that you are hearing, you may have heard sound bites of it previously in your life. And there's something really evocative about his installations. It's a very new and emerging technology that is, on one hand, completely technologically advanced. So, for example, the work he does is never, it's not on a loop. It's not repeated. You'll see it once. You'll never see it again. And he has the ability through, you know, massive computational programming to take these algorithms produce these events. So he is amazing. I do want to talk about scripting because we are now in that territory. So for example, my firm, we've always had one foot in academia, one foot in practice. The students, now graduates who work for my firm, were building a new website. And part of that website, we will post scripts from Rhino and Grasshopper and various ecological plugins onto the website as open source documents that students can then go to and cut and paste and create their own versions. It is not copying, because they will then manipulate it for their own needs, but it does set a basis for students to learn from a simple script on a website.
It's like a tool.
Right. I'm wondering, what do you think about downtown Brooklyn when you come here and you look at, well, you live here, but when you look at what's going on with all these new buildings, what's your feeling? Because to me, it's starting to feel like just a bunch of buildings. You know, I'm looking for this theme that you might see in some cities, or maybe there is a theme and I'm missing it because I don't think from an architecture lens, so to speak, or see from architectural lens.
It's a challenge. And this is a lifelong challenge between traditional architecture and avant-garde architecture. So traditional architecture is always on time, on budget, and It definitely delivers the product that it was expected. But if you begin to push the boundaries of architecture or open space or gathering spaces, especially in the times that we've just been through with COVID, the idea of assembly now has become really important. So biodiversity is a big topic right now. The idea of greening our cities, because the temperature drop by simply planting a tree is dramatic. So we're seeing cities.
Simply planting a tree?
A tree,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So
all right. I've got trees on my street.
So for example, we've got the High Line in New York. Mm-hmm. Vancouver is another really good city.
Oh, that is such a gorgeous city. Yeah. I love
and
Vancouver.
And it's so green, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, taxi drivers don't like this, but because the streets are narrow. But it does create bikeable and walkable cities. And of course, Scandinavia has been doing this for decades, and we're just catching up.
But there's also an aspect to it of like buildings, like in some sense, you could take these buildings that are being built and designed and built in downtown. They could be anywhere. They have no relationship per se to anything that's unique about Brooklyn. And I know a number of architects who actually spent a fair amount of time learning about the environment and doing things that are in accordance with where they are, for example.
Contextual.
But we don't see a lot of that. And I think also going forward, do you see a lot more of that happening, or do you see it's more like, we need a building, get this international style thing and plop it there? Or?
I can address that. So for example, in Manhattan, we have Billionaires Row. And those are a series of, super tall, thin residential towers.
They look like
towers.
Cigarettes or something.
They do.
It's just ridiculous
they do.
Looking, I
is
think.
Is it 59th Street? I think it's 59th
Street. I mean, there's something
Street.
That yeah. when you're on the Whitestone Bridge, yeah. you're like, what the heck? What a skyline.
Well, the thing is, they're all designed by very famous architects. Mm-hmm. They're all very expensive residential towers. And the most important thing to note is they're all empty. They've been purchased by people from overseas. And they're
yes,
just simply not,
properties,
they're
yeah,
just
like
not
London.
Occupied. Yeah.
This has been really fascinating. There is one question I have, which is I was looking at Masterclass yesterday on Frank Gehry, and he was talking about foals. Like,
yes.
What do you think about that? I mean, I wonder, a building that looks folded, like just like this mask right there, just folded. What do you
Okay, well, it's very interesting. I have a very simple answer. If we take the F-150 fighter jet, there are two versions of that jet. And the purpose of the jet is to deflect radar so that it cannot be perceived in the air. And there are the two versions. One is faceted, which is a series of straight plates that break up the radar so that they can't recognize the single object. And then there's a smooth version, which does the same thing. So folding or pleating or curving, complex curves, produce the same effect. And that is true of architecture as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Joe. This has been a great conversation. I've taken so much from it. I thought that I'd be lost, but I wasn't. You're a wonderful communicator. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.